Listeners, we may not all be on the lam from the cops and the mob at the same time, but we know what it's like to burn the candle at both ends. So when you need a jumpstart, don't settle for that crummy diner coffee the assassin serves you. No, you deserve Sparkplug coffee. Coffee lovers know that the secret to the best coffee is freshly roasted beans. Well, Sparkplug roasts their beans within days of delivering it straight to your door. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans sourced directly and fairly traded, and if you're too busy planning an elaborate long con to keep track of coffee orders, Sparkplug has you covered. They offer autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Hey, folks, and mucho thanks for opening an ear to the next 100 Project as we continue to augment our 123 Top 100 Project podcast selection with this new phase. If spoilers piss you off, then get out of here. My con man name remains Ryan Ellis, and I'm seated with my well-scrubbed hustler of a wife, Bev.
That's me.
Ooh, a reference to Silence of the Lambs, for no reason whatsoever. The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Sting, which is one of only two 1970s movies that won the Best Picture Oscar, but didn't make either of AFI's top 100 lists. What's the other movie?
Well, it's going to be the subject of next week's podcast. It is Kramer versus Kramer, one of my favorites. I really like that one.
It was a bit of a layup there. It was an easy one, yeah. 8 of the 10 made the list. Sting probably was close. Kramer versus Kramer probably wasn't close. I don't think really in the end. We like it. We'll talk about that next week. But anyway, this week we have the next 100 Project's fifth movie, The Sting, which was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Of course, did not make it. Universal Pictures premiered it on Christmas Day, 1973. Ding, 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 diddle-ding, ding, ding, diddle-ding, ding. And New York City and Los Angeles. Critics sang its praises, the Oscars heaped prizes on it, and audiences made the flick a monster hit. But, for those who aren't familiar with this movie that's more than 40 years old, Bev, describe The Sting with The Skinny.
Paul Newman is Henry Gondorf and Robert Redford is Johnny Hooker, two con artists in 1930s Chicago who plot to grift a huge wad of cash from the vicious mob banker, Robert Shaw's Doyle Lonigan, who killed their friend.
Doyle Lonigan, get it? Or in a nutshell, no job, no prob, rob the mob, starring Paul and two guys named Bob. Shaw and Redford. Okay, so the story on this movie, the Rotten Tomatoes critics. 93% of them are fans of The Sting, 51 fresh, 4 rotten, 95% of audiences. Wow, pretty strong scores. But listen to this, the sequel, The Sting 2. 0% of critics and 30% of audiences.
That was an accomplishment in itself to get a 0 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Jaws of Revenge, I believe, is a sequel that we covered of a very acclaimed movie in the 70s and then a sequel that got trashed. So back to the original Sting, 1973, 89th on the IMDb's 250, pretty strong ranking there. And here is the motherlode of numbers. It's 20th on Box Office Mojo's Top 200 when adjusted for inflation. It was 19th until Star Wars, The Force Awakens in recent weeks has passed it, and almost everything else. Sting has made $743 million. That's more than Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Godfather. It was number one in 1973, which was ahead of The Exorcist and American Graffiti. But curiously, and I think this is because of re-releases, The Exorcist is higher on BO Mojo all time. But enough about the numbers, Bev. What are your thoughts, your feelings, your gut instinct on The Sting?
Well, it stars my two boyfriends, Paul Newman and Robert Redford.
They're dreamy.
They're dreamy. Their charm allows the film to remain really fun and entertaining without giving up too much of its grit. It executes this really fine balancing act between authentic crime film and just the silly joy of watching these two impossibly charismatic con men pull off the job. It's kind of like some like a Hot meets The Hustler. The characters are a little shallow, and I do wish I could go back and experience The Sting before seeing all of its copycats, because the thrill of the surprise ending was completely ruined for me. Now that everybody has taken that to the nth degree.
This is the first time we've done the next 100 Project movies that Bev has not seen it going in.
That's right. This is my first time seeing the movie. So seeing The Sting back in the 70s probably was absolutely delightful and surprising. But seeing The Sting after you've seen Ocean's 11 and Focus and Matchstick Men and unlike all the movies that borrowed from it in order to keep surprising their audiences. Because the great thing about The Sting, and I think something sounds to me like it was the first film to do this, was it wasn't just conning Doyle. It wasn't just conning the cop, it was conning the audience mm-hmm. so that they weren't in on it and they got to be just delighted. And it all works out in the end. The intricacies of the plot does add up in the end. So it's not stupid, it's a little far-fetched, but it's not impossible.
Does the movie play fair? The movie lets us in on most of the scams except the hitman turnabout and the FBI twist at the end. So is that playing fair or is it a little bit unfair with us? And by the way, you just talked about twists a second ago. That was not common in 1973.
Yeah, if you look up con men movies, and I did just Google search, nothing comes up before The Sting. Even though certainly movies like that existed, something like I mentioned, The Hustler, but this vein, like this particular type of con man movie that's supposed to be fun, where the audience is rooting for them to get away with it and delight in being surprised. It's almost like watching a magic trick, right? You kind of want them to pull the wool over your eyes and delight you at the end.
I'm talking about multiple twists because the hitman thing is out of nowhere. It's the woman who's at the diner. You did that in the spark plug sponsor at the top of the show. And then the whole thing with Polk at the end. Yeah, we pulled it over on Lonigan, didn't we? Yeah, way to go, buddy. Yeah, you get out of here now. And yet it is set up because we see Redford put the blood capsules in his mouth.
Oh, you see, I saw it. Because you've seen it six times. Yes, right. Watching the movie for the first time.
A note I'd made before we sat down to watch the movie, I always do my pre-search before we even watch the movies. Is Johnny Hooker, Redford's character, in on the whole twist of the variant? Well, of course he is, because he's playing that he's been shot, and then when you see the blood capsules go in his mouth, he's even more in on it. The only thing he doesn't know about is the twist with the fact the woman he banged, let's just say fucked, the woman he fucked is the woman who's trying to kill him. Although, why does she kill him before the guy says, oh, too many people saw you guys?
But she was going to kill him out in the open in the middle of the day in the alley? That's part of the plot that's a little far-fetched and perhaps that's not fair. But the ending and the way they pull one over on the cop as well as Lonigan, that is fair. That falls within the spectrum of possibility.
The funny thing about a movie that's all about twists, and I remember this with Jaws. It's not about twists, no. But Spielberg said that when he had that whole thing with Gardner in the boat, the head popping out, and the audience goes nuts, is that people didn't trust his movie anymore because they always trusted when Dan-dan played, then the shark is there. When that didn't play, the shark is not there. He bends that rule a little bit towards the end, doesn't really break it. I'm thinking about a movie like this, though, where there's twists upon twists and all these other things going on, and do you really trust the movie? So if Gondorf doesn't want to let Hooker in on the fact that he's going to watch his back, okay, fine. But I just wonder if that's really playing fair with us, and maybe I don't need to drag that point out anymore, but it's one of those things about the movie that isn't funny. The movie is supposed to be a flat-out comedy. At the very most, it's amusing. I've seen the movie many times. I didn't laugh out loud during the film. You didn't laugh out loud during the film. Not a guffaw kind of laugh, not a Coen Brothers kind of laugh. And it's actually, for the first 5 to 15 minutes, deadly serious because they robbed this mob guy. It's not really all that funny to do that. Maybe a smile about the fact they pulled it off. But then when Lonergan's people kill Luther, the friend, and the whole thrust of the movie is that their friend's been killed, that's not funny. And actually, Redford, who is the thrust of the whole film, he's the main character, his character's not amusing at all.
No.
Newman brings life and charm that he does, also in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Same co-star, same director, George Roy Hill, way back in Butch Cassidy days, 4 years before this. That movie is way funnier than this film is. I know you weren't a huge fan, but I was. But this one, even though it won all the awards and was such a gigantic hit, if you think of it as a comedy, sorry fans, all these years later, I'm going to say it isn't that funny.
But I guess it's not a drama either, because it does have a light heart and a light touch.
Because we want to see this bad guy, Lonigan, get taken. He's a banker, but a crooked banker, so we always want to see those guys go down. Hey, the movie that might win the Oscar in a few weeks, The Big Short, is all about crooked bankers who take an awful lot of money from an awful lot of people, and who wouldn't want to see somebody like a Paul Newman, Robert Redford, just take them for whatever they possibly can, because fuck those guys.
But then Redford would give it up, because he would just blow it anyway. Another far-fetched thing at the end of the film, like, really? You're not going to take your cut? And by the way, I looked it up. $500,000 in 1936 today would be worth $8.4 million.
Ooh. So all those guys they employed to pull off this scam, It does seem like a lot of people to try to employ, but maybe it's worthwhile because they can all get a pretty damn good cut. And it's worthwhile in the end anyway because Redford wants revenge. The rest of them want to just help out their friend Gondorf, who's helping out the dead friend Luther.
And I guess Lonergan isn't a very beloved mob boss. And all these criminals, he somehow is unaware of any of them. He doesn't recognize any of these career criminals, which seems also a little unlikely.
He just wants to win and he'll take whatever he can to get it. I was wondering about that though too during the film. Was their presentation convincing enough? They do a good job of having all these actors playing people within the story that are just watching the horse race and getting off on that. Past posting. That just means you're betting after the bets are closed. I don't know how Lonergan wouldn't have found out through whatever it takes. I don't know anything about betting. I don't know anything about horse betting in the 30s. The Depression, we haven't said that yet. This is during the Depression. That this is a scam, not necessarily just on him. Let's say he doesn't even believe it's about him in the end, but that the race has already been run. Ray Walston's character is narrating something that's already happened, being creative, obviously, and improvising how they finished. But you would think that he would find out somehow that that happened minutes ago, I guess it would be. And yet somehow he doesn't really check up on those sources either when he's investing a lot of money to try to win on this race.
It's 1936, so how would you check up on that stuff? This is before most homes even had a telephone. Certainly weren't televisions, and if this stuff wasn't broadcast on the radio, if you had to go to an off-track betting place to even bet on the ponies if the race is happening out of town, then what other option would you have? You would have no way of checking this stuff. You would have to trust it, and he would be accustomed to trusting that kind of thing because he probably has made bets in other off-track places before.
Which are legit. I'm also wondering, as people who are about to go to Vegas in a few weeks, us,
yes,
not gambling types, but we will bet some money because why not? We're going to Vegas. But is this one of those deals, too, where somebody who is already throwing himself out there, he's a banker, but he works for the mob, is a part of the thrill of the victory that you don't know necessarily what's really involved in this whole thing? He's got to trust the Harold Gould character, Kid Twist, and then this Redford character who is playing multiple people in the whole film. Maybe Lonergan somehow deep inside of him wants that thrill of, I don't really know what's going to happen.
Don't they say at the beginning of the film, the key to his success is that he only does things he knows he can win? He only takes chances on things he knows he has an advantage of. That's why he cheats at cards. There's a great Malcolm Gladwell book called Outliers where he addresses the super rich and he says that the one thing they all have in common is that they find a weakness in a system and they take advantage of it. And that's what Lonergan does by cheating at cards, and that's what he does by cheating at off-track horse betting. They know that's his nature, so they give him an in to take advantage of this off-track betting place.
You know what? As you say all this, you're convincing me. The key scene of the whole film to make him believe this is legit is when he goes to the office that isn't Kid Twist's office, but they just do the whole painting thing, the picture on the desk. Oh, Kelly, we gotta take Lonergan somewhere else. We gotta talk about this in some neutral place. You just sell that this guy is real. You sell that the off-track betting is real, and it's good enough. That is the key. That guy having this office that isn't really his office. So, yes, okay, I'll buy this. You're convincing me right now.
And who would expect somebody to hire all those actors to create such an authentic off-track betting place?
And Lonergan has no reason to think that anybody, Redford's character or anybody else, would be trying to get revenge on him, but they would have the kind of in to make this kind of stuff happen in the first place. There's a lot of people to get involved in this whole thing.
Yeah, you could really poke holes in this. This is all really far-fetched. They had to have everything go absolutely perfectly for this plan to play out, and if one little thing went wrong, if that UPS guy just came back to his office in the middle of that whole thing, they would be dead. Lonergan would kill them for what they did.
Yeah, fella.
Yes.
That's the line. I didn't have it earlier. Yeah, fala, Bev.
So, it's definitely hard to believe when you think about it, but let's talk about the strength of the film, which is that it moves at a great pace, you have these really talented actors, you have this really sharp script, and it keeps you going. You don't pause long enough, nor do you want to pick apart all the nitty-gritty of the script. I mean, it's a little difficult to follow, which might be easier on repeated viewings.
It like is.
Yeah, right? And I found myself working hard just to keep up with the plot, but the suspension of disbelief wasn't a challenge because I was caught up in the movie. I didn't really care. This is what we always say. If you're enjoying the film, it doesn't matter if it's absolutely believable and accurate.
Until you get to this point where there's a review to be written or a podcast to be done, and of course you're going to pick holes in it. But if you're enjoying it during the moment, then that's all that really matters. Now, we probably didn't say earlier, the movie is set in Depression-era Joliet, Illinois, at the very beginning. Then we go to Chicago for most of it. In September 1936, also based on a true story of sorts, probably more based on true events. And here's the thing I've loved on the Top Nerd Project so often is actors who get to act within the context of the movie.
Mm-hmm, that's one of your favorite things.
Because most people in life are acting one way or another. Most of us are not truly honest with people. Oh, often, especially when there is murder, or there's money, or there's love, or there's sex involved, we're putting on a front. And movies just heighten it, because that's what movies are supposed to do. Redford and Newman and all their friends are playing confidence men who take you into their confidence. I'm thinking about David Mamet's House of Games. Not a movie I love that much. Siskel and Ebert, huge fans of that movie. 1987, see it at least once. For one instance, The Card Game, where Ricky Jay is the dealer, I think, is in that scene. Joe Mantegna and Lindsay Krause, I believe, is the woman involved. Great example of con men isn't about I'm going to con you. It's about I'm going to bring you to my confidence. I'm going to trust you. And that's what makes you trust me. And that's what they do to Lonigan in this film. No. I'm going to tell you right off the bat. Kelly on the train, while Redford's character, Johnny Hooker, Gondorf is cheating. That's how he beat you. And here's your wallet back. They stole it from you. All those things are true. But then he doesn't know that Kelly / Hooker is actually out to screw him over too. So I'm bringing to my confidence, but that's actually just ensnaring you in my spider web. And one of the things we've seen in a few films, including The Godfather for sure, dirty cops, because that is the Charles Durning character.
Oh, yeah.
He was in Tootsie, good performance. We loved him in Dog Day Afternoon, which we also reviewed for the Not 100 Project quite a few months ago. Whenever we see dirty cops, we kind of want to see them get screwed over too. And in the end, it's more about just getting him out of their hair. But he's got to be ensnared in this whole con too, which is why the thing with Dana Elkar, who worked for 50 years in the business, plays FBI agent, quote-unquote FBI agent Polk. That whole scene plays out like it's real, but the only person who doesn't really know what's going on is Charles Durning.
Well, actually, the audience doesn't know what's going on either, which is...
Yes, within the movie, the only person
so cool. Knows, yes. It's such a great reveal at the ending. But you raise a really good point. There's the despicable villain, but there is something so extra loathsome about corrupt cops in movies.
Like in The Godfather. The whole reason why Michael wants to kill Sollozzo and McCluskey. Sollozzo is a problem. He's trying to kill their father. He tried to kill their father. Okay, fine. You can understand that. Even Michael can probably respect that in a way. But McCluskey, I'm talking about a dirty cop, a cop who takes my bad version of Pacino in The Godfather where he has the broken jaw. But anyway, the point is that he is trying to take down the cop as much as he's trying to take down the crook who tried to kill his father. But let's get back to the actual crook in this film, Doyle Lonigan, who kills for pride, which is Luther, because they took from him. As much as he wants the money, he wants to just make his stamp. And also, he would say survival to maintain his grip on power. You fella? Because if he lets that up, much like in the Godfather films, actually, the year before this movie, the Best Picture winner the year before this movie, and the biggest hit of all time the year before this movie, which surpassed it. And then, of course, a couple years later, Jaws surpassed that.
And they say right at the beginning that the reason he has to go after them is because he just says... He lets him get away with robbing one of his men. He'll lose his hold on Chicago.
And if you can relate to these crooks, you can kind of understand why they have a problem with that. So it may not be cool, but okay, buddy. If you're going to be that kind of hood, then...
I'm still rooting for my boyfriends.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why you are rooting for them, because it is Newman. It is Redford. Newman only had one AFI film, which was Butch Cassidy. Redford was in that, and of course, All the President's Men. But beyond the AFI movies, they are two of the legends of the history of the business. Newman's one of the all-time greats. You've mentioned The Hustler already. One of my favorite movies. I've seen it so many times. Very cynical film. Very hard ending. Bad ending in a way. But let me quote the sequel to that movie, The Color of Money. Money won is twice as sweet as money earned.
And that is a little insight into the mind of a criminal. And there's no point in the sting where they talk about how great it's going to be to have that $500,000 and what they're going to do with that money. To them, their motive seems to come entirely from just... First, burning Doyle, and second, getting Doyle and the cops off of Hooker's back so that he can fake his own death and get away with...
Presumably move somewhere out of Illinois.
Yeah, with no money because he's opted out of taking his cut from the con.
Oh, blow it. He walks away with his buddy Gondorf, who's going to show him all kinds of new scams they can run and probably lose more money. Well, money, the return of the word dough. We haven't heard the word dough since the 30s, I guess, or AFI films. Let's go get her dough! This movie's got some anachronisms, though, because the famous music is Scott Joplin's ragtime music from the 1900s, 1910 era, so about 20 years before the sting is actually set. They didn't care. They wanted the music so bad, they just said, well, put it in Depression-era Chicago, because why the fuck not?
Yeah, it was written by Scott Joplin, but it was performed for the film by Marvin Hamlisch. Mm-hmm. His version of The Entertainer became a top 10 single following this film.
He also won 3 Oscars in this year alone. 2 for The Way We Were for song and score, and then the adapted score for this one. That's got to be a record. 3 Oscars for one composer in 1 year. 1 is for song, of course. He did music for Sophie's Choice, which is on the Top 100 project. We covered that way back when. But the music is the thing that people think about when they think about this movie so often, along with, even though it's so much less, the Burt Bacharach music in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which, as I said, is by George Roy Hill, the director, and her 2 stars in this film. So their collaborations, those 3 guys, has very famous music in both cases. I do love the 1930s lingo. Maybe don't hit it on the head too much, the Edward G. Robinson kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I do like this touch. Gondorf, the Paul Newman character, is called Mr. Shaw on the train, and he's playing cards with Robert Shaw. I also love when the guy who leaves his bank job, it's during the Depression for some random con. He has no reason to think that this is actually some job he should be going out for. Maybe they're just saying, we might make a little bit of money on this. Who knows they're going to make that much money. But fuck my bank job.
He was just waiting for one of his criminal friends to call him and get him out of that dreary job.
I also admire the division of labor in this film. The delegation that Gondorf does, because he is the main guy. And he lets Kid Twist lead a lot of this whole charge. He lets Ray Walston have some hand. He lets, obviously, Hooker have an awful lot of power. I've never been very good at that myself when it comes to delegating things. My softball teams, for example. So I admire Gondorf for being good at that, because he is the one who knows all these scams. I'm telling you things only a couple of guys in the world know about. Hooker, this may not be a nice touch exactly, but it's a surprising touch. It's very atypical of modern movies, and I mean in the last 35, 40 years, where hot guys sleep with mediocre-looking women.
Oh, yeah, I said that while we were seeing the film. They're both totally slumming it. During the opening credits, they actually show each of the players, and they introduce them and say the name of the actor playing them. And I remember thinking, there must not be a love interest, because there isn't a single attractive woman in this movie.
Eileen Brennan, though.
She's not ugly, she's not homely, but she's certainly not...
In Newman's League?
No! My God, no! Not even close.
Nor is the hitman in Redford's League, but he's settling. I'm just like you. I don't know anybody. So I'll fuck you, because why not? Redford shouldn't have to settle for anybody.
No.
Okay, so let's get to the ending of the film, because that is the key. The David S. Ward screenplay, when he was peddling this out there, which, by the way, was found in a pile by Rob Cohen, who later went on to direct Dragonheart and The Fast and the Furious. So this guy was in Hollywood in a low-key, entry-level kind of job back in the early 70s, who said, let's make this movie. This seems like a pretty good screenplay, and somebody finally listened to him. But Ward's screenplay, when he finally got people to listen to him, his whole point was, I'm not going to let you read the ending until you read the rest of the script, because of the big twists. Now, speaking of twists, Kid Twist, the Harold Gould character, does say to Lonigan on the phone, he wants the horse in the end to place your money. I do like that touch, though, because, of course, if you don't know this about horse racing, to win is, of course, to finish first. To place is to finish second. To show is to finish third. So he does say, place your money on whatever the fuck the name of the horse is. I can't remember this moment. But then when he walks into their fake establishment, I said to place. Another nice touch. I don't know if you noticed that or not. But it's worded in such a way that you can see why Lonigan would say, I misunderstood you.
Mm-hmm.
So very good touch there.
And of course, he's naturally going to be in a hurry because of the way they screwed him around on the last one, where they wouldn't allow him to place a bet by getting everybody in line.
They boxed him out.
He hears the name of the horse and he goes. He doesn't think about it. And it's such a great touch.
Mm-hmm. So if the first big twist ending of the whole film is the lady hitman, then the bigger twist is at the very end when Polk comes in. Did you see that coming? Because you said it didn't surprise you much as you should have, but did you actually see that there'd be gunfire? With what we see for a few seconds is that Newman and Redford's characters, these huge stars, both gunned down, at least for a few moments.
Okay, I didn't know how it was going to end, but I knew there was going to be a twist. I knew there was going to be something that the audience wasn't in on. And this is just, unfortunately, because all the Sting's copycats have taken this conceit so far to the next level that I was genuinely surprised that that was the entirety of the twist. You know, I'm so used to people who really need to fool their audiences would have had that and then another twist on top of that, because audiences are just, because of the Sting, they're already expecting an ending like that.
Oh, you mean after they were both fake shot and then Dane Elkar's character says, okay, we're good now. You thought there's something else coming after that?
Like in Focus, that movie is almost making fun of the genre. There are so many twists on top of twists on top of twists. It never ends. It's exhausting. And I found that a very charming, entertaining movie. I'm not really complaining about it. But the plot was ridiculous. To expect the audience to go along with anything by the end of the film was outrageous. And I kind of checked out. I don't know about everyone else. But you have so many films that have done this and totally copying the Sting like it's a playbook. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Matchstick Men, Ocean's 11, American Hustle, I've seen this 100 times. This thing actually seems too simplistic now.
Those are some good titles, mostly, that you just mentioned there. Should I bring in the Jaws quote again, that you don't trust the movie?
Yeah, I absolutely did not trust the movie, and I saw a twist coming a mile away. I didn't see that twist coming a mile away. When they got shot, there was not 1 second that I felt peril, like they were actually dead. I was like, oh, okay, so part of the con is that they're going to pretend to die. I wonder where they're going to go with this, and then that was it.
And back in this era, that's probably what clinched the Oscar for them, because no one had seen a movie quite like this before.
And that's great. Kudos to them, because it obviously was such a clever trick. At the time, it's unfortunate that it's been, I don't want to say done to death, because it's not as if it's a robust genre. You see a film like this come out every year, but often enough. Mm-hmm.
And hilarious as well. Shooting people is so funny. Okay, here's a question for you at the very end of the film. They stole from the mob. How long do they have to live? Have they convinced Lonigan that they're actually dead well enough? I guess they have, but is he going to go back to his hotel or even his home, wherever he lives, and say, wait a second, those cocksuckers got me.
Well, a conspiracy is only as strong as its weakest link, and you had 20 people in that room with you. You're telling me that none of those criminals and lowlifes are going to turn around in a moment of desperation and tell Lonigan what really happened? When they leave town, they better put a lot of distance between themselves and Lonigan.
Well, Newman and Redford do get going awfully quickly, and they're headed for a train at that point, maybe very wisely. And this was the start of a lifelong friendship between Bob and Paul, the Merry Pranksters, who started their whole prankster set on Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. And I guess they did that all through their lives beyond their movies. They never did a third movie. They only did these two. They were great together. The movie does pick up so much steam when Newman comes into it. The only humor that's really in the film is when Newman's evolved. Redford doesn't bring a lot of humor in this movie, although he was nominated for the Best Actor Oscar. But in the Newman and Redford flicks, the two of them, you always seem to be rooting for the criminals. In both cases, they're not exactly good guys. They're stealing from a crooked banker in this film, or a mob banker, as it were. And in Butch Cassidy, they're stealing from an asshole, over-rich train guy. So they're root-forable in that sense, but they are stealing.
Yeah, but they're so good-looking.
That's what it comes down to, isn't it? But not only are they good-looking, Newman in this film has convenient alcoholism. When we first meet him, he's an absolute drunk, but he can turn it off when he wants to. Yeah. Another movie trope.
Totally.
And as you said already, he'd already played a hustler in The Hustler. Great film. That's on Netflix. If you've never seen The Hustler, and if you're a fan of our podcast, you really should have. One of his best works and one of the best films of the 60s. Redford wasn't the first choice for Johnny Hooker, though. Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson both turned it down. Nicholson went on to do The Last Detail instead, a movie that's nowhere near as successful as this film. Most films weren't. But I don't think Nicholson regrets that. Redford has said he didn't watch it for more than 30 years. And I have this question for you, Bev. If actors don't watch their own films, why should we? You hear this a lot about actors in Hollywood. I don't watch my own pictures. I don't go to the premieres. Or at least they don't watch the movies at the premieres. They just go to the red carpet and then leave. Then why the fuck should we give a shit? And I like The Sting. I'm not actually criticizing this film, but I hate that mentality.
I get it. They're never going to be able to experience the film the way you and I experience the film. They're never going to be able to watch it with fresh eyes and see what we see. So if you're tortured by watching yourself on screen, if it really is just too much for you, then why put yourself through that at all?
I say, man up, that's part of the job.
Why is it part of the job?
It's part of the job. You're making movies. If you can't watch what you do on screen and maybe learn from it, maybe take something from that for a future performance, then fuck you.
Are you arguing that Robert Redford is bad at his job?
No, hell no. But this idea that actors, not just him, have, I can't watch myself on screen. Then okay, little Sally, as you'd call me, go tough it up somewhere else.
Wow, you really hate it.
Okay, Robert Shaw, the third lead in the film, we of course know him from Jaws. He had an actual limp in this picture because he hurt his leg before they went into the shooting, so he incorporated it into the character. And this could have been Sterling Hayden, who also could have been Quint in Jaws, but then Shaw got that role too. And then Ray Walston, who does play the guy who narrates all the racing, was in The Apartment a long time ago for us on the Top 100 Project, and then is Mr. Hand in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Eileen Brennan, the Paul Newman lady, was in The Last Picture Show. And then Harold Gould, who is Kid Twist, 60 years in the business, 200 credits. Exactly 200 credits, how about that? And then Jack Kehoe, who is Kid Erie, Redford's buddy from the very first scam, was in The Untouchables and many other films. And that's the cast.
Oh, you're forgetting one cast member.
Okay.
And that's Robert Earl Jones, or as I shall always know him, Vader, I am your father. Because he is James Earl Jones' father.
Oh, Luther, the one who was killed in the early part of the
film. Yeah, you can see in his face and his voice, too. His son definitely resembles him.
That opening scam, did you see that coming? Did you know what they were doing with that? Did you see that there's going to be some kind of twist on the mob here? They're going to take from that mob and steal their money.
I knew that they were stealing somehow. I didn't know exactly how they were doing it until you see the mechanism. But
when you watch that scene closely, when you see Redford put the money in his pants, he puts it on, I think it's the left side, and when he takes it back out to show the mob guy, it's on the right side, or maybe have that backwards. But the point is that he's got the double in his pants already, and if you look for it, you can see it happening. But of course, I've seen the movie so many times, and I am looking for it. George Roy Hill, the director of Butch Cassidy, The Sting, and Slapshot, also with Newman. That's a fan favorite of a lot of people. Hill won the Oscar for this film. What do you think of his direction?
It's very adept. It's a little clinical. It's not a very emotional film. You don't really get caught up in the characters all that much. But considering he had the tall order of making that plot coherent, he did that very well. And visually, he told the story very well.
And unlike the movie that might win Best Picture later this month, The Big Short, because it does have the inside track at the moment, he doesn't fuck around with this camera, nor did Coppola the year before on The Godfather, which won Best Picture. French Connection, ironically, the year before The Godfather, did. That was a lot of handheld. That was putting a guy with a handheld camera in a wheelchair and moving him around. But in The Godfather and The Sting, obviously Godfather Part 2 that follows this film, the camera is very steady, very true, and he puts it in the right place. And that is what a director is doing as much as anything else. David S. Ward wrote the screenplay. He also did write the reviled Sting 2, and one of my favorites, I have to say, Major League, 1989, the baseball movie. Yeah, I love Major League. I always have.
I loved it when I was a kid, when it came out. I haven't seen it since I was, you know, 14 years old.
One of the great YouTube clips for me late at night where I've had a few too many drinks is to find the scene where Charlie Sheen comes into Wild Thing.
Yeah.
You make my heart sing. I hate this fucking song. All right, the producers of The Sting, Tony Bill and Michael and Julia Phillips, who we talked about on both Taxi Driver and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. She was involved in those three big pictures. Michael didn't produce Close Encounters, but he did co-produce Taxi Driver, so big work by those people in those movies. And Julia Phillips is the first woman ever nominated for a producing Oscar, so Best Picture, and she's, of course, the first to ever win the Oscar for Best Producer.
Really?
But here's an interesting little tidbit for 2015, now into 2016, but the 2015 movies. Seven women producers are nominees in the Best Picture field this year in our eight movies. So that's pretty good.
Finally catching up on one thing.
I've looked, actually. There have been quite a few in the last maybe 10 or 15 years.
Producers,
we're going to talk about this. Yeah, we're going to talk about the whole thing about the lack of black actors for two straight years in our Oscars preview in a few weeks. We'll do that when we get to that point. We'll probably also talk about the lack of women or anyone other than white males when we talk about that whole thing in that little special. But we've seen more, at least, I'll say that, in the 2000s and now into the 2010s, we've seen women, we've seen black people who've been nominated for Oscars in these major roles, just not the last couple of years, but these women are in the Best Picture category in many instances. The Sting is 185:1. Watch the Blu-ray print. I thought it looked pretty good for a movie that's of this age.
Hell yeah.
And the cinematographer, Robert Surtees, who shot Ben-Hur, The Graduate, and The Last Picture Show.
Yeah, and great, he credits. Tried to make this look like a film from the 30s. The colors, they had a brown, earthy tone.
One thing that George Roy Hill and he agreed on as well is they had very few extras because they looked at James Cagney films. And a lot of those crime films that he did, there'd be nobody in the streets when all the big shootouts were happening or the big events were happening, or at least very few people. Not many extras at all. And The Sting did the same kind of deal. That's why when Redford is wandering around at night, nothing to do, I don't know anybody, and he ends up fucking the woman, he's looking at this diner and there's really nobody around, is because Hill is homaging 1930s era gangster films.
I got the feeling from this film, even though I know a lot of it was shot on location in Chicago, it felt a great deal like it was in a studio lot.
Most of it was in a studio lot. Henry Bumstead, old Bummy, who collaborated with Hitchcock and Eastwood for most of his career, he won another Oscar for this picture, and they mostly shot on sets. And the reason why is because of the problems with period authenticity.
Sure, yeah. It's a good
reason. We're talking 4 years before and also in the Depression, so if you wanted to do that, you're going to have an awful lot of budget problems. So yeah, they would set scenes in Chicago, know you're supposed to be there, and then they'd have a set where you'd actually have your main action take place. The editor, William Reynolds, who did cut The Godfather a year before this film and The Day the Earth Stood Still, these guys, Surtees and Reynolds, with some incredible credits. We talked about Marvin Hamlisch, the composer. Edith Head won her eighth Oscar for this movie for the costumes. And her quote was, she's just costuming Redford and Newman. That's pretty easy.
No trick there. If I was costuming them, I would have made it look hard so I could spend a lot of time with a measuring tape in their proximity, you know, tell them to undress and dress over and over again. Oh, it's just so hard to get right.
You know what? I may be a guy, but I might agree with you on that. And their star appeal is one of the reasons why this movie succeeded, no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think there's a ton of influence despite the success of this film, but I'll say these ones. I've talked about The Sting 2, 1983 was when that came out. Jackie Gleason and Mac Davis. But then there's also, of course, the twist endings in movies and The Imitators, and we've talked about those already. So anything else you've got about influence?
It may not be a large number of films you could say are children of The Sting, but the films that do follow this blueprint really follow this blueprint.
Except that they add to it by having even more twists.
Well, because they have and then more.
You know, in the movie you didn't mention, Wild Things.
Oh yeah, oh, it took me a moment.
Even during the end credits, there are more twists and yes. more twists and even more twists. I like that movie. Yeah. I've not seen it in a long time.
That's a good point.
Okay, the AFI and Oscar credentials, and it's mostly Oscar stuff. It won 7 Academy Awards: Best Picture, Best Director for George Roy Hill, the Ward Screenplay, the Editing, Mummy Sets, Head's Costumes, and Hamlish's Music. The 3 failed nominations, Redford as Best Actor. What a great crop that was. It was Redford, Nicholson, Lemon, Brando, and Pacino.
Wow.
Lemon did win for Save the Tiger. The cinematography was nominated, and the sound also was.
There was quite a bit of pedigree in the Best Picture category that year, too, because this film beat both American Graffiti and Cries and Whispers, which is one of your favorites.
And The Exorcist.
And The Exorcist, yeah, that's right.
This is also the movie that was nominated and, of course, won the year when The Streaker at the Oscars happened.
Oh, is that right?
That guy who streaked before Elizabeth Taylor and David Niven, I think maybe, were going to present Best Picture. He ran out right before they said, the Oscar goes to, or back then it would have been, the winner is The Sting.
Every best moments of the Oscars montage from now until the end of time is going to feature that stupid streaker.
And it's been said the fix was in, that was deliberate. So a bit of a sting, a bit of a con. Or was it? Or I don't know, maybe not. Okay, The Sting is in the National Film Registry and has been since 2005. That was the year of Giant, The French Connection, Toy Story, along with Cool Hand Luke. So 3 of our AFI films and a great one in Cool Hand Luke. Good year at the National Film Registry. AFI nominations, but did not make it. The Sting was nominated for the Top 100 Laughs, but it's more suspenseful than it is comedic. So in a way, maybe it should have been nominated for the Top 100 Thrills.
Yeah, could have been.
And then the Top 50 Villains for Doyle Lonergan. Fala.
I don't agree with that nomination. I don't think he was quite as great as everybody else thought he was.
He's probably better as a villain in From Russia with Love, one of the great Bond villains of all time. All right, so parting thoughts on The Sting. Our first of 3 Best Picture winners that didn't make the list. We're going to do The Sting. We'll talk about the next week's film in a second, and then American Beauty to end the month with an Oscar preview on February 22nd. But there you go, Bev. Hit it. Your last thoughts on The Sting.
I enjoyed it. I think it's slick and adept filmmaking, playful, entertaining, without being dumb. I wish Hill had made it slightly less convoluted, because I actually found the effort to keep up the plot distracted me from enjoying all those machinations. But maybe, like Chinatown or The Godfather, it'll just make it richer with repeated viewings, like you said.
However, as a guy who's seen this movie a lot more times than you have, I don't think I like it more. I think I like it less, and it's maybe because I didn't laugh, and because I know it too well now, so it hasn't improved with age. This was not an AFI film, in retrospect. I may have said in some of our podcasts it could have been or should have been. Now that we've seen it, I don't think it should have been.
Okay, I have to agree with you. I don't feel like it got robbed of a place on the list, really. I enjoyed it. I can see why it's a classic and why it's important in its pocket of genre, but I don't feel like it deserved to be on the list.
We plan to do The Exorcist later this year. I don't think we'll be saying the same things, as in, I don't like it as much, the way I'm saying about The Sting. American Graffiti had so many imitators for so long, maybe even to this day, with music and having this nobody cast, these kids, night in the life of kind of thing. The Sting has been referenced by other movies. Exorcist, though, has been imitated by so many, and it's still such a scary movie for people who've never seen it before. And you may not be a huge fan of American Graffiti. I know you've seen The Exorcist. If you were to recommend one of those 3 movies, which one would you pick?
Oh, American Graffiti. Okay. It's not like I'm against American Graffiti. I don't like it as much as other people. I'm not as much a fan of willy-nilly following people around.
And Dreyfuss is the star and you're not a fan.
Although, actually, you know what? I am a fan of that genre because I love when Richard Linklater does it. I think it's just Dreyfuss. I think I just can't stand Richard Dreyfuss for whatever reason. But American Graffiti is really more innovative in the way it shook up how a film could be structured. The Sting doesn't do that. It doesn't reinvent the wheel the way American Graffiti did.
Well, with these twists, maybe it did. But American Graffiti, and you mentioned Linklater, we didn't even talk about when we did Before Sunrise, the movie that people mostly like in his oeuvre.
And Dazed and Confused.
Which is 20 years after American Graffiti.
I always forget.
And similar to that in so many ways, but another take on it. And it's set in the era of American Graffiti. Well, when it was released, not when it was actually set. Graffiti is set in the 60s. Dazed and Confused, released in 93, is set in the 70s with all that great music. So to wrap up The Sting, I liked it too. I wouldn't put it on the list. I don't think I'm going to see it again for a little while. Yeah. I'm a little surprised to say that. I thought I was going to commit to this podcast saying, how did you not like it more, Bev? I thought I got to convince you. Let me shake your shoulders. Nah, it's not as good as I hoped it was going to be. I'm a little disappointed. So anyway, in 7 days on the next 100 Project, I will be 42 plus a day, and we will bring you the answer to this week's trivia question. It's another blockbuster, the divorce drama, Kramer versus Kramer. So the coming attractions trivia. KVK was number one at the domestic box office in 1979. What's the next instance of a Best Picture Oscar winner also leading the pack as the biggest box office attraction of its year?
That's a great question. Okay, so for the answer to that, please tune in to Ryan's birthday podcast next week.
Yeah!
Kramer versus Kramer. 42 years old.
Old man.
Oh, it's disgusting. Honestly, I can't. I don't even know where to begin.
A drinking out of my age.
Yes.
No ice chingling there. It's all gone.
What he's not telling you is that he's drinking prune juice and tonic.
I ain't drank for nigh on to 3 centuries.
Oh, this is a terrible tangent. I have to apologize on our behalf. So anyways, tune in to next week's podcast. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, rate us, review us. It helps people find us, and we love that. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. We are both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or if you would like to message us privately, our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, before we go, I would like to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
We're done, ya fella.
And cut.